Welcome to Rethink Possible, a joint effort between CISO, the Center for Effective School Operations, and MASA, the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. Rethink Possible podcasting explores pockets of awesomeness in school districts as told by school district leaders. I'm Bob McDowell, your host. Let's dig in. Welcome to another podcast of Rethink Possible. I am excited to have Assistant Superintendent Tim Wald with us. He's the assistant superintendent in White Bear Lake for White Bear Lake Area Schools. And today we're talking about how he and his team moved from planning to implementation with regard to both facilities and programming, really this emphasis on how do you get everyone to think like a designer and be a designer in the process. So thanks for being with me here today, Tim.
Yeah, thanks, Bob.
Yeah, so to start off with, how do you get to a spot as the assistant superintendent? How do you get to a spot where you decide, I got to come up with a plan really to move people, not just to implement something big, because you guys had a really big move, not just facilities, but also programming changes. But how do you get to the spot where you decide, here's how we're going to do this?
Yeah, good question. When you take on the challenge that we took on of, we're going to attempt to pass a really large bond referendum and develop our schools from being really pretty aged, pretty old, outdated facilities to something really modern, really forward ready, that will bring the energy to the community, to our schools, and that will help us move ahead where we want to go from a teaching and learning perspective. So it's a big challenge. And so we took that on, recognizing that this would be our primary work for a number of years. When Wayne Kazmierczyk, before he became superintendent, he was our assistant superintendent for finance and operations, two retired teachers/coaches, Jim Galvin and Don Glover, approached him and said, Wayne, in this role you're in, you might have the ability to do something, and we think our schools need a lot of investment. What can we do to help you? And both of those guys have a lot of clout in our community, well-respected guys, both in their respective coaching hall of fames. Still contribute significantly to our community. So they asked the question that, you know, we were thinking is, when's the right time to make the move? And Wayne was hired as superintendent in 2017, and he needed someone to replace him. I was high school principal at the time. He asked, would you be willing to take on this role? And we're gonna have a lot of work ahead of us. And so that was an exciting proposition. How can I turn that down, right? So I was really, really pleased to have that opportunity. It's a once-in-a-lifetime career opportunity for anyone in this kind of leadership role, right, to make a really significant change in your school district. So so that's really where it began, is Wayne taking the superintendency and saying, all right, first we need to create our strategic plan. Within that strategic plan was addressing our facilities. Student agency was an important part of that strategic plan. So how do we make our facilities future ready and flexible so that as teacher pedagogy evolves to meet student needs, our facilities can support that. So that was really kind of the vision that we had going into it.
When you get that vision, how do you start to put together then the pieces of, if this is the direction we know we want to go, how do you start to put the pieces of who needs to be on that team? Who needs to be making those kind of first directional decisions about, here's how we're going to do it?
Well, it started with Wayne and I, and then our cabinet come together to do some brainstorming around what are the steps we need to take. getting key leaders in our school district at the table, people who had significant experience, but also were those forward-thinking kind of leaders. Terry Dahlem, who you know, was our principal at Anika Elementary at the time. She was one of our key leaders. She was just about ready to retire. So it was great to have her for those first 6 months just to kind of get the ideas launched. Then we brought the concept to principal leaders and really began to move from there. Really, we needed to identify who would we be working with on this from a professional standpoint. And so we started to interview architectural firms who would help with the bond referendum part of it, who would be our construction managers. So we started, you know, interviewing those firms to come up with a team that we felt really confident with and who had been around the block a few times in this world to help support us on that. So we did that, and out of that came, they helped us solidify our plan. So we had already completed a few 2017 and a 2018 demographic study that indicated we were going to see significant growth in enrollment. And we had completed a deferred maintenance plan of our buildings, which identified about $450 million in maintenance projects that were needed in our buildings.
Wow.
So that was a little intimidating because as you begin work like this, your mindset is we're going to do something really forward thinking mm-hmm. and we're going to create something the community is really proud of. Then you start to think about the really practical side of maintenance mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. that you have 17 sites and they all need a lot of maintenance. And so, it's so we had to balance those two things, really consider how we're going to upgrade our facilities and maintain them.
That when you're thinking about that, how much time do you think was spent on the, from a balancing standpoint, decisions around here's the deferred maintenance versus let's put up a new building and what's the cost, right? Because you can keep an existing building and plan out 10 years and say, yeah, this is going to cost us a lot of money to upkeep. Or does it make more sense to try and pitch the idea of let's put up a new site that in the initial cost is going to be large, but then we don't have the deferred maintenance over the 10 years.
Right. For the most part, those were questions we asked. Our high school being one of those considerations, because we had two high school buildings, neither of which were great, right? One was built in 1964, three round buildings, circular buildings, a design that, you know, at the time was really designed to reduce the, reduce the expense of building a school. So if you have a round building, you have less hallway space, and it's just a more efficient build. Problem is, a round building is really hard to supervise. It's really hard. It's harder to maintain, right? You never need a square in that building. And then our other building was a 1972 build, and that was built in industrial design and really built to become a warehouse or something else, thinking they wouldn't need it down the line. But that didn't play out that way. We needed the capacity in the 70s and 80s beyond what they thought. Idea came in, and all of a sudden you're using a lot more spaces for special education, and schools just require more square footage than they used to. Yeah, so we talked about, Bob, should we just level one of those, find a plot of land of 100 acres, build a new high school, discover there's really not a good space within our school district for a 100-acre high school. And the cost of building it would just have been significantly more. So that's where we came up with the plan. And our architects, you know, we had a good, dove into our buildings, got a good sense of what was possible, and then suggested some ideas that brought us to where we're at.
So when you get to that spot, where does it start, or when or how or did it transition to where you were trying to balance what you knew you wanted to do forward thinking with programming and what the actual physical plant was then going to look like at these different sites? Like what started to drive what?
Yeah. Great. So we selected our architectural firm, World Architects and Engineers. They had, you know, they're kind of the biggest firm for K-12. We wanted a firm that we thought had the capacity to handle the number of projects, 17 different projects that we'd be doing over the period of about 5 years. And we clicked with them just in terms of they thought like educators. They taught us eventually to think like designers, but we were impressed that they spoke our language really well. They thought from a student perspective. And, you know, we shared with them that we wanted to be daring in this. Paul Applikowski asked us, if you think of that you want to be daring and you want to be future ready, and you think of that being way to the right or, you know, going all the way to a really extreme level or just a little or maybe kind of halfway, where are you at? And we said, well, we're way beyond halfway. We're not all the way to the far end of that, but we want to push up pretty close to it. He said, all right, it's going to be a ride. Let's go.
Around that concept, how did you decide, as you're planning kind of the plan at this point in that process, how did you decide who made sense to facilitate what conversations and drive them?
Yep. We felt like we needed to have a school district employee be the face of the committee. So the first committee we pulled together, district facilities committee, and it was a committee of 90 stakeholders, district employees. We had some retired teachers on the group. We talked about Jim Galvin, Don Glover. They were on the team. We had parents. We had students. So this group of 90 met for months and months and came up with the plan that we brought for the referendum. And then once the referendum passed, then we had to answer that question of what does the future of education look like? And how are we going to design, how are we going to develop the core design principles to be ready for the future of education? Because these are buildings that are going to last us for, 100 years in some cases. So they have to be future ready. So we formed a committee called the Future of Learning Committee, kind of a grandiose title. And that committee, again, made up of educators, parents, students, and we developed some core principles for future-ready design. And that's what we used as kind of the basis for how we started our design work.
As you did that, you came out of that first committee. How did you structure or come up with that kind of that logistical layout of, if we have these core principles, now here's what has to happen. Here are the dominoes that have to fall. Here are the committees that need to meet. Here's how we're going to cascade those meetings to start to align the plan and move from planning into planning to implement.
Yeah. We formed what we called core planning groups. So we had our design principles and some key ones, like one of them that I really appreciated was the learning on display. We don't want learning hidden behind four walls with a door with a little window that's covered with construction paper, right? We wanted our students to walk through the hallways or walk through the building and see instruction occurring, seeing what's happening in classes and being inspired by what they're seeing. Teachers are proud of what they're doing. And for the most part, teachers want you to see what they're doing in a classroom. And so we decided, let's try to get to that point where people can walk through our building and see what's happening. And then there's the consideration of safety and security. And if you're going to have glass in your classrooms, and what does that mean? And the maintenance and cleaning and all those types of things that had to be addressed and looked into. We did a lot of site visits. the fear of, well, if people can see into the classrooms, then students can see out of the classrooms and they're going to be looking at their friends all the time. They're not going to be focused on what's happening in the classroom. And when we talked to the people in those buildings, they said, yeah, you know, a couple weeks, that settles down and it's really not an issue. Movement outside of the classroom has just become white noise. Right? And so we trusted that and went ahead with the design. And I'll say that when we opened our new elementary school, North Star Elementary in Hugo, which has a studio design. And so there's five classrooms, you walk in there's a large flexible space in the middle and kids are not really confined to a classroom. And so it was like maybe middle of the first week of school, maybe 5 days into it. And Wayne Kasperchuk and I walked in, two older big bald guys walking through a second grade learning studio, right? You think that's probably going to distract some kids. Totally didn't. In fact, like, do you not see us? No. So like some of the kids just looked up and smiled and just went back to what they were doing. And then we did the same thing in the high school. We walked into a learning studio, seven classrooms, there's 125 kids in there. And they're, you know, there's distinct learning spaces, distinct classrooms. But there, some are have glass that you can, you know, you can see what's happening in the rest of the studio, and some are very open without exterior wall, you know, or without a wall to the learning space or to the flexible space. So, and you walk through there, and really within about 3 days, teacher said, the kids were, it was just white noise. They were not paying attention to movement around them. They were just doing what you're doing in the classroom. So the teachers, like, this is working way better than we thought it would.
As you're moving through all of that, the communication has to be a huge piece, right? You've got a giant staff. I mean, you're a decent sized district, so you've got internal communications, and then you've got a very vested community in White Bear Lake. What did you have to think about and make sure you were doing from a communication standpoint, from all the way through this, to try and keep everybody connected and not feeling like they were left out?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, what happened about, what, 4 months after the referendum passed, COVID hit. We went on spring break and we never came back. We didn't come back that year. So, and those were really when we were kicking off our design conversations. And so we had our future of learning committee that was done. We started that right after the referendum passed. We were done with that by the end of January. And then we were beginning the core planning groups. And then we went, COVID hit. And so the best laid plans of bringing people together in a room and doing some physical design and manipulation became more of a challenge. Everything had to be done, through virtual meetings. Which we were really worried about, but went exceedingly well. But we had good engagement. Our architects adjusted quickly and held all those core planning groups, which included mostly teachers, but some parents and students as well. The two big projects were the elementary school, because that was a new elementary school, 110,000 square feet, and then the high school. We had a building with 280,000 square feet, and we were adding on 375,000 square feet. So those were the two really big projects, and we had a lot of small additions or redesigns in many of our elementary buildings, middle schools. So all of that kind of, all those dominoes had to fall into place.
How do you think in that process, because you mentioned when we were talking earlier about that part of the goal of this was to make sure that people felt like they were the designers. What do you think happened that really caused that to become a truth for you?
I think it was, within that process, we were really, really clear that we don't know what these schools are going to look like and we need your help. And so I think that was really one of the most powerful parts, was that our leaders, our principals, our teacher leaders, our student leaders, and our parent leaders had input on what that was going to look like. And so they felt like, wow, this is a pretty unique opportunity for me. And so they dialed in. And, you know, who doesn't want to design a new school? That's a pretty fun thing for anyone interested in education. Yeah. And so that was really, I think, the magic in it was giving people the power to, the input to help design the schools. Yeah.
Besides COVID happening, while this all kicked off, what do you think from your perspective, from your chair, right, as the assistant finance operations really tasked with oversight of how do we drive this thing? What from your chair do you think was the hardest, most difficult thing to do to get it from start to finish?
There were so many unknowns at the time. And, you know, I hadn't worked construction projects of any significance, really, other than small building projects, you know, renovations of spaces in the high school when I was high school principal. So I didn't have experience on a big project like this. So for me, just building the capacity to know how to how to lead the school district and represent the school's interest in that process so that things didn't get away from us. And so I promoted one person within our organization, within our building operations department, to be the project manager for us. And then our director of building operations served in that role too. It put a lot of stress on some other people within building operations. I would have added more support, used some of those referendum dollars to add more support than they did in the project management. Second part would be within the finance department, because when you pass the $326 million referendum, plus we had $75 million in LTFM on top of that, you're spending a lot of money in a very short amount of time, and you want to make sure that all your internal controls are in a good place without overtaxing your staff. And I think to some degree, we overtaxed our staff.
So with these podcasts, I usually end most of them with maybe people consider it advice, not advice, but really it's a question of, given this situation, if there's, whether it's a superintendent, assistant superintendent, director of operations, really what would be the one, two, or three things that you would give or share with them if they were faced with doing this? Like what would be, if you were going to do it again, here's what, make sure you've got these things in order as you enter into the process of doing this type of facilities and programming change.
Yeah, well, you know, they would say the thing that I would make sure we did again that I felt really good about was public involvement early in the process. So having that committee of 90 people who met regularly was so powerful, and it meant, I think when we had conversations with the community, Wayne and I did over 120 presentations, evening presentations, before the bond referendum. And being able to share that we had this group of 90 people who've been working on this plan meant a lot to people, that it wasn't just school district leaders, it wasn't just school district staff, but parents, and then community leaders who didn't have kids in school, but are just taxpayers and passionate about schools. So that, I think, was an important part of it. And I would do it the same way we did. And then secondly, then, I think it's just building that internal capacity within myself as a leader, or as a someone with leading a construction project. Boy, I wish I knew then what I knew now, and I would go back and just learn more about design build process and what are potential pitfalls, understanding how to maximize bidding processes, especially in those really core areas like concrete, HVAC, electrical, plumbing, those really big elements of it. You know, we, on the high school project, we used best value in those areas. I think I would use best value more often than I did, because we vetted out contractors either way. But I think, I probably would have extended the best value for some of more of our projects than we did.
Fantastic. Well, today we've been talking with Assistant Superintendent for Finance and Operations, Tim Wald, with White Bear Lake Area Schools, about how he ran a giant facilities and programming upgrade for White Bear Area Schools, and they're in the process of finishing up a five-year plan. Thanks so much for being with me and explaining how you went through that process, Tim.
Bob, you're the best in the business.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Rethink Possible with Bob McDowell, a joint effort between CISO, the Center for Effective School Operations, and MASA, the Minnesota Association of School Administrators.